I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Hello, this is Mike Swanson, and in a few moments, you're going to listen to another segment of Parallax Views. But before you do that, let me tell you about my new book, Why the Vietnam War. It's a sequel to my previous book called The War State, which has lots of positive reviews and Amazon's been out for years. But this one is a more detailed case study of how American Empire and National Security State operate using Vietnam. And I believe it shows also how things work today, how policy is actually made and why. So grab the book on Amazon.com, Why the Vietnam War.
Hey there, Parallax Views listeners. On this edition of the program, a conversation I recorded early last month, on August 10th, 2021, to be exact, with Robbie Martin of Media Roots Radio and Connor Freeman of the Libertarian Institute on the subject of alt-media figures who may be a bit more hawkish than some think. The launching point for this conversation was Sagar Njeti, formerly of Rising with Crystal Ball on The Hill. He now hosts Breaking Points with Crystal, which, with the endorsement of Joe Rogan, has become one of the most popular current events and politics podcasts around today. Now, if you're a fan of Sagar and Crystal, and I've watched them myself, this is not meant, at least on my part, as some full-out assault against them. I think there are some interesting questions to be raised about Sagar and Njeti's stances on China and U.S. foreign policy towards China. That being said, I don't want anyone to think that this was a personal attack on any of the alt-media figures we mentioned on this episode. But I do worry about where things are headed for alternative media as we seemingly have gotten ourselves into a new Cold War for the 21st century. So with all that in mind, let's get right to the conversation with Robbie Martin and Connor Freeman. Welcome to Parallax Views. First time guest, Connor Freeman, and returning guest, the great Robbie Martin. How's everyone doing today? We're going to be talking about a certain neocon wolf in Dove's clothing.
What's up, JG? What's up, Robbie? How you guys doing?
Good to be on again, JG.
And thanks for having me on.
Awesome to finally meet you, Connor, over the internet.
Likewise.
So we're going to be talking, and this is probably not going to get me any favors in the world of alternative media, but I felt the need to talk about it. We're going to be talking about Sagar Njeti of Breaking Points with Crystal Ball and formerly Rising. Now, someone recently said to me that, well, why would you be doing a show on Sagar? That seems kind of boring, but I think there's a reason to do this. And I don't know, do you want to start, Robbie, or Connor, do you have a statement?
I have Connor. Yeah, Connor, go first.
Yeah, sure. So I have known for a minute, because I follow Robbie, that that there's been a sort of a thing going on the left where Sagar was brought in. He was hosting this show with Crystal Ball, who's formerly of MSNBC, called The Rising on the Hill. And I thought that was interesting because I knew – I forget at one point I realized this guy comes from neocon think tanks. And the story gets even weirder as
Hudson's
as
the big one, right?
Hudson Institute for the Study of War out of the Kagan orbit, Kim Kagan's think tank there. and we'll get to Don Kagan's thankful death. But I'll just say it's interesting to me that no one really talks about this connection. Then you learn other shady things about Sagar, like, you know, his background studying counterterrorism at an Israeli university, IDC Herzliya, on a former military base that's connected to James Woolsey. He sits on the International Advisory Board, you know, another PNAC neocon who.
Wait, James Woolsey. Damn.
Yeah. Well, I mean,
Woolsey is also known, not to break in, but for people that don't know, Woolsey was like the CIA director and whatnot. He's now pushing this line that Oswald was directed to kill JFK by Khrushchev. And then before that, he was one of the people pushing the line that it was Iraq and Saddam Hussein behind the Oklahoma City bombing. But go on.
And anthrax, and he was in Operation Dark Winter. Sorry.
Yeah, no, and he's also with the Committee on the Present Danger China, which is another interesting connection.
Yep.
And Ehud Barak is also on the board of this IDC Herzliya. And I believe the guy's name, the head of the counterterrorism department in this university, is Boaz Gannor, who is connected to like the the ACT.IL app from the Israeli government that Alan McLeod has also written another piece about, where they basically artificially infiltrate online discussions and then push Hasbara whenever Israel needs some help with their PR, like when they were bombing the hell out of Gaza in May. And so what's interesting is, you know, Sagar is this, you know, huge China hawk. You know, if you YouTube search Sagar and Jetty Rising China, it's like if you YouTube search Tucker Carlson China, it's some of the most alarmist, hyperbolic, well-written, frankly, well-presented fear-mongering you can find. But what's different about Sagar is, putatively a sort of independent media figure. But it's not really disclosed.
Real quick, just briefly here, and I want to – the reason we're talking about this ultimately is because I think Breaking Points, which is the successor show to Rising now that they broke from the Hill TV and whatnot, this is probably the most popular, if not I was going to say one of the most popular, if not the most popular political podcast out there. It has surpassed Pod Save America. It has surpassed all kinds of –
Ben Shapiro, Bannon's War Room. It's number one last I saw.
Yeah. So to me, it seems very important that we talk about this. And, you know, I think part of Breaking Points getting this popular is probably due to, I think, Alan McLeod in his article for Mint Press News about this referred to Rogan as the sort of Pope of podcasting. And, you know, getting an endorsement from Rogan has really helped Breaking Points, but go on with what you were saying about Sagar.
Oh, well, yeah, I mean, it's so Sagar has done, you know, he's comes from the Hudson Institute, which is funded by arms contractors, like our military industrial complex firms like Raytheon and Northrop Grumman and I think Lockheed. And, you know, they get money from South Korea, Taiwan, Japan. And so they're one of the most hawkish anti-China think tanks out there. So it's pretty, you know, and also, of course, there's a lot of anti-China stuff that comes from PNAC, and, you know, he worked for Kim Kagan, so there's a connection there. It's just very suspicious that this guy then is sort of, like you said, anointed not only by Joe Rogan, but by other prominent figures on the left, and kind of laundered in that scene to the point where the guy has a arguably he may be as influential as Tucker is with the older demographic, with the younger demographic that consumes independent media, so to speak. And so that's why I think it's really alarming.
I wanted to say something real quick, and we'll kick it to Robbie here in a second. But Connor, so I think there's people on the left that haven't wanted to necessarily step on too many toes when it comes to Sagar. But are there people on the libertarian and conservative side who may have similar inclinations of, we don't want to pick on this guy too much? Because it seems like Sagar and Crystal Ball, I think, have really pushed this line that they're the populists. And I think a lot of people left and right have been reticent to criticize them because of that.
To my knowledge, Kyle Anzalone, friend and partner over the Libertarian Institute, he has a show called Conflicts of Interest. He's also the editor at antiwar.com, and I am on that show a lot. We discussed this, and I'm pretty sure we're the only libertarians who have discussed this publicly. I've written an article about it for the Libertarian Institute as well. But to my knowledge, those are the only libertarian outlets that have touched on this issue. And I will just say that there is definitely there's a split. Dave DeCamp of antiwar.com talked to Robbie about it on Media Roots, that there's sort of this idea of like, you know, should there's parallel strategies of that are not necessarily conducive to joining forces, of either infiltrating the Republican Party and trying to get the populace to be like anti-war libertarians and kind of merging with them that way and seeing that as being a more practical strategy to achieving the kind of the desired ends of the libertarian movement, or just
sort
going,
of like the left has the DSA strategy.
Yeah. Or the LP strategy, the Mises Caucus, which is what I support, that Scott Horton and Dave Smith are involved in, where it's basically redoing the Ron Paul revolution, but using the LP as the platform to do that. Cause it's the third largest party. It's already there. The infrastructure is there. We just have to take it essentially and run a real campaign and not a bullshit campaign. Like we've seen in the past. So, but there is also a hesitancy. I'm not sure how aware, by the way, people are of how bad Tucker and Sagar are in terms of the anti-China stuff, or how aware people are on the libertarian side of the new Cold War with China and how risky it is. Patrick McFarlane is at the Institute is one of the best on this issue, particularly the Uyghur genocide claims and the proliferation of propaganda in the so-called independent media scene. But really, the Libertarian Institute is and the antiwar.com are the only there's a lot of good stuff, I think, against the coming war with China, but I off the top of my head, it's hard to even think of. But I think our institute does the best job on it. But there's also, I'll just say, in the libertarian movement, people who don't want to step on too many toes and alienate the right wing populace because they see them as potential partners. But I think that's doubtful.
I think that's something we also see on the left. And I just wanted to add, because I know I'm going to get this criticism for doing this episode, this is nothing like personal with Engedi or Crystal Ball or anyone associated with Breaking Points. It's like, you know, I will credit Sagar and Crystal when they've done shows with people like Trita Parsi, who I have a lot of respect for. But some of the stuff I've seen coming out of Sagar in particular, I'm a little put off by, especially the hawkishness with regards to China. And that's where I wanted to kick it over to you, Robbie. What do you think the issue is with not being critical of someone like Sagar and Jetty? Because I think there is a real danger in not being critical when we need to be.
Wow. I think it's what it shows is that, and I'll just say it outright, whatever this infiltration attempt is, has succeeded to a level that I maybe haven't witnessed before in my time being active in politics. You know, I personally believe that it's impossible, as Sagar claims, to have been inspired by his resistance to the Iraq war to get into politics and become a political pundit or whatever. He worked for Kim Kagan in 2014, writing articles for the Institute for the Study of War. It just doesn't add up. It doesn't make sense. So, yeah, I'll be the more paranoid sounding one and just say that I think that this is the result of a very dangerous infiltration attempt where, for the first time ever, an actual neocon think tanker has somehow gotten and gained influence and prominence in the left, like the actual left, not just like liberalism or, you know, generic progressivism, but like the alternative media left that you see dominated by a lot of these YouTubers and things like that. And I think it's also largely due to the fact that some of those people like Greenwald, even Jimmy Dore, has regularly promoted not just Breaking Points and Rising, but specifically Sagar. They seem, you know, there's a lot of love, mutual love. So.
Hey there, Parallax News listeners. Before we continue our conversation on this edition of Parallax Views, I want to notify California listeners of the program about one of our sponsors, the therapy practice of Alexander Yu. Yu is an experienced teletherapist since 2008, and he goes by the motto, flow, adapt, change, as Lao Tzu would say. And he wants to accompany you on your journey of self-improvement. Now, again, this applies to California listeners of the program. Alexander is a licensed psychotherapist and teletherapist. And if you'd like his services, then please contact him at Alexander U. That's Alexander U. YOO.com. And he can be reached by email at therapy@alexanderu.com or by phone at 323-834-9828. That's 323-834-9828. This is only available once again to my California listeners, but if you need anything related to therapy needs, please be sure to contact our sponsor, Alexander U.
The point I wanted to get at is, you know, I think that Sagar is the most successful attempt, but I think we've also seen other attempts by people who describe themselves as populists that used to be neocons.
Sure.
Trying to sort of cozy up with the left and libertarians and conservatives now. But in my view, Sagar has been the most successful, and I think he's been the most open to really pushing the line when it comes to the conflict with China, or we're pushing for a new Cold War, essentially.
Well, yeah, I mean, for sure.
I was watching clips of Sagar the other night, and he goes, like in between two commas, and one, and while he was talking to Chris Lee, he's talking about China vis-a-vis the U.S. and U.S. policy, and he goes, and you know, the coming fight between us, and I'm just like, what? Just inserts that in there.
Yeah, Sagar has been, I mean, that's been one of the things that has obviously been a giant red flag to me this whole time about him, is that it's directly relates to the content that the think tank he used to work for was pushing heavily, the Hudson Institute. And as Connor already said, they are the most openly aggressive think tank towards China. But one
isn't Pompeo
more
there now?
Yeah, yep. He's there now. Scooter but Libby. I think, yeah, Scooter Libby is the vice chair of Hudson Institute. But I think one thing that sometimes gets missed in this is that the Hudson Institute actually produced the first podcast Sagar and Jetty was on, called The Realignment. And his co-host is a guy who was actually caught in a documentary, I believe it's called The Lobby, where he's recorded on a secret camera basically admitting to lobbying for the Israeli government. So his co-host was caught on camera saying he lobbies for the Israeli government. Hudson Institute is producing a podcast that's called The Realignment, which shows that they have interest or some utility in promoting this idea of a populist left and populist right realignment happening, which I think is interesting. Why would the think tank be producing a podcast like that? Why is that their branding? And I think it's because they're smart and they're ahead of the curve, you know, sort of ahead of a lot of these other think tanks in D.C. where they've actually rebranded as populist. So even someone like Tom Cotton, you know, he used to just act like and appear as a straight up neocon. Now he's sort of like presented as like this bright populist guy. And it's like, no, we know that's not true. You know, I mean, some of these people have jumped into the fray more recently, like Josh Hawley and Matt Gaetz and stuff like that. So they can get away with acting as if they are, you know, anti-neocon and populist. They even criticized Bill Kristol on Twitter. I think Matt Gaetz did for being into murdering people in the Middle East. But it's so funny when it comes to Cuba, when it comes to China, you know, when it comes to all these different countries, Venezuela, they're straight up neocons. I mean, there's almost no difference between them and the Bill Kristols and Robert Kagans when it comes to Iraq and things like that. So,
and I want to be fair to Sagar here, because I know someone's going to bring it up. That co-host may have been working with the lobby, but Sagar has been critical of Israel at various points, especially recently. So I'll give him that, but I want to come back to the realignment thing.
Sure.
Because I think, Connor, you were talking about that on conflicts of interests. What is the realignment? What is this whole idea? And what do you think it's – I think it's Trojan horse, to be honest.
Oh, yeah, I think so, too. So the realignment, like Robbie was saying, is this show that was – it's literally a product – well, it was developed at the Hudson Institute. It's him and Marshall Kosloff, and the concept, which was really transplanted over to The Rising. Because, see, her original
co-host –
But it's
not just a podcast. I think it's an idea that they have, this concept. Sure. Yeah.
And so originally it was Crystal Ball and Buck Sexton, who's from the CIA. They had a show on the Hill called The Rising. Sagar at Hudson had this show with Kosloff called The Realignment. And the concept there is that, like, the winds are changing in politics, and now the right populist and the left populist can get together because now we have these things in common. It's kind of part of the post-Trump era, where I really think neoconservatism is rebranding in various ways. And if you weren't already hip to how much they were pervading, you know, ostensibly alternative media like Vice, et cetera, or, you know, BuzzFeed and these kinds of things, with the anti-Russia stuff in the years past that you see in, like, A Very Heavy Agenda, Robbie's documentary, then I think a lot of people would have been caught off guard. And the concept is, like, these left populists, these right populists can get together. So one of the things that they'll do is, like, if Pat Buchanan, who's anti-war and usually pretty good on these issues, even if he cedes a little too much of the official narrative on China, he's still against all the U.S. intervention there and is very actually very good on this issue, particularly the military provocations and all the anachronistic, like, security guarantees with Japan, et cetera. Or Taiwan and this sort of thing. And so if you look at this, it's like, okay, so the populists have this issue with all of the jobs being transferred, shipped over to China and this sort of thing. And so what I feel like Sagar and people like that do is they take kind of the legitimate anger at the establishment, and then they channel it towards China under the framework of what used to be kind of like anti-NAFTA populism. But that didn't also have a component to it that included – and also let's follow through on, like, the Asia pivot and PNAC's kind of let's put two-thirds of naval forces and build a forward presence in southeastern Asia. You know what I mean? Like, it's what's really disturbing about it is because – so Crystal Ball will be like – Sagar will go on a rant for like 10 minutes about China, how they control our entertainment, they control our banking, they control our media, our sports, and all these different things. And he goes, this is their economic warfare. This is how they depleted the United States. Now everybody's killing themselves on opioids. And he just goes on this whole rant. Then at the end of it, he goes, and it's all for profit. And then she'll go, well, that's unbridled capitalism for you. This is what happens when you worship the almighty dollar. And so if you look at it through the most cynical lens, like, because this comes from a friggin' neocon think tank. That's the cynical take on the realignment, I would imagine, because it's kind of like if you look at Bernie Sanders, somebody like that, he's a real hawk on Russia and pretty bad on Syria, for instance. And I've seen this as part of a larger trend where if you see Bannon, he's got this populist thing, but he's working with Frank Gaffney at the Committee on the Present Danger China. Huge hawk on China. You know, we're going to be at war in the South China Sea in 5 to 10 years. There's really nothing populist about that. You know, we're spending more on the military than we ever have as a nation. That's the worst thing you could do for people who desire real populism. And what are they going to get drafted in some war that could end in nuclear devastation, killing millions here in America? You know, like what are we talking about here? Because they're sort of manufacturing consent in sort of a new way where it's like they're just hyping up the fear of China in the independent media, because I think people do have some sort of war on terror syndrome akin to like Vietnam syndrome. And so they're changing, they're adapting to how they push propaganda for the great power competition era. And I think this is part of that.
Robbie, do you have anything you'd like to add to that one?
No, I mean, I completely concur with everything Connor said. I guess the only thing I'll add is that, it's really interesting now that they've sort of jumped from what was it, The Hill that hosted Rising, and now they're going independent. And you also see a lot of these other sort of, I would just say, the suspicious personalities also sort of defecting from their outlets or institutions and acting as if they're independent now, like, for example, Barry Weiss, who seems to have all this influence in the sphere of sort of the anti-identitarian, you know, seeing the intellectual dark web scene and stuff like that.
Trust me, so I know a lot about Barry Weiss. She was born and raised here in Pittsburgh. It's the biggest disgrace of this city, in my opinion.
Yeah, but no, everything Connor said is exactly right. And I think one of the most interesting things you said, Connor, is that I do think this is catching people off guard, and I do think it's throwing people off because I don't think a lot of people were aware that the Russiagate stuff or the anti-Russia hysteria was really thriving in left or alternative media or like Vice, as you said, BuzzFeed, Daily Beast, before it sort of evolved to, you know, the more mainstream level. And now we're seeing the same thing with China. I mean, it's pretty much across the board. You even see some of it even coming into left, you know, so-called left spheres with people like Matt Stoller now. And I find that, you know, particularly disturbing because I already think Cigar and Jetty's amount of, you know, his stature in the scene is already some kind of infiltration. So then when I see someone like Matt Stoller, you know, basically echoing Steve Bannon's talking points about China and Wall Street, I get pretty concerned.
And I'll just add about libertarians and the strategy of working with right populists. When I said I was doubtful, what I mean is if something isn't done to thwart this propaganda campaign, because if you get a bunch of people who are right populists who also are hawks on China, that's a poison pill. Because I'm more concerned about that. Like what I write about and talk about is exclusively foreign policy. That's my focus. So as far as the libertarian movement and this opportunity with the LP, I look at it as the greatest opportunity for the anti-war movement to actually build a coalition around that. I think that's very possible. You could see something like what Ron Paul did in the past. And also you could get people who are good on the left and good on the right as a part of that, I think. And I think this kind of op sort of throws a monkey wrench in all that and is more or less done to preempt something like that happening yeah. wherever it would come from. And I don't mean to say that I'm doubtful that right populists could be good on all these issues. I'm saying that I want them to be, and that's kind of why I talk about this stuff, because I don't have anything. I don't really care if you're on the left or the right. Domestic politics isn't my focus. I'm focused on foreign policy. So if I can get you to be good on foreign policy and do what I can there and discredit this system and these people who are running, carrying water for it, whoever they are, Tucker, Sagar, or, you know, whatever, then that's my focus. So I just want them to be better is what I'm saying, I guess.
I just wanted to ask a question of Robbie here. And I mean, I've had guests from all over the political spectrum on this show. And for me, I'm fine with having guests on that are critical of China or critical of Russia even and Putin. But I feel as if Sagar's approach to this, I feel that the Breaking Point sort of approach and the Hills approach, it really to me mirrors a lot of the stuff we see on the mainstream TV shows. It's, you know, the how do you put it? Soundbite politics.
Wait, what was the question in there? Sorry, JG.
Well, I was just asking for your opinion on how Sagar and Crystal approach talking about China, because I feel like a lot of what we see on Breaking Points, and, you know, especially when they had Rising, I felt that it was a lot like the soundbite politics we would get on Tucker Carlson's show.
Yeah, I mean, I think what's different than the Tucker Carlson show is because it sort of has this, you know, the left and the right populace working together, you know, credibility by the mere fact that it's Crystal and Cigar sitting together. She plays the role of the left populace. It gives the phony appearance that they are actually hashing it out and arguing, having a real debate when, say, the topic of China comes up. But as Connor already mentioned, it always seems to be rerouted into some, like, basically bullshit framework or framework that in some way supports or props up this sect of these DC hawks that want to, you know, basically escalate things with China. So I think that that's mostly the real danger behind Breaking Points, as it's now called. I don't know. I can't really speak to the exact rhetorical differences between them and Tucker and what makes them more dangerous. I just think that it's all the other things we're talking about that make them more dangerous. And I do think a lot of people know that, you know, they are familiar with Tucker. He has a reputation for being this weird lackey with a bow tie who came from MSNBC, then CNN. You know, there are some people who are weary of him.
Sauber used to work for him, no?
You know, I don't
know. Yeah, the Daily Caller.
Okay, yeah, he did. But I think it's, you know, with Sagar and Crystal, they're sort of a clean slate. People know them as being these populists, you know? And Sagar is very articulate, and he does say a lot of the right things. But I, you know, I just think the clues are all there. The China stuff is very suspicious. He does want American hegemony to remain and be prominent in the world. He doesn't want some kind of bipolar or multipolar world. He's said it many times. I mean, he is basically a neocon think tanker at heart.
Yeah,
so
that's quintessential.
Tucker Carlson is not. You know, Tucker Carlson is, you know, is just a more of a showbiz performer guy, pundit. But Sagar is a trained neocon thinker. He learned counterterrorism as like part of his post 4-year college degree. You know, he took another 2 years to learn counterterrorism at this place called IDC Hursley that you already mentioned. Who does that? Who's actually interested in populism? That's such a strange thing to do. I mean, I'll let your listeners infer what I mean by that. But, you know, as Connor already mentioned, Crystal's previous co-host was a CIA agent who actually is quoted saying, and I'm paraphrasing, that his job in media is pretty much identical to what he did in the CIA. And that's where he learned how to do media. And his job in the CIA was also counterterrorism in Afghanistan and Iraq. So make of that what you will. I don't know what Sagar really is, but I do think it's possible that he is some kind of sheep dip something, you know, either sheep dip neocon think tanker posing as a populist or something else.
I got to be honest. Go on.
Well, there's a great line in Alan's piece where after he's done talking about IDC Hursley, he goes, "This is an institution that trains Israeli and American intelligence officials, not radical populist outsiders."
Well, that's the other thing I was going to get back to. One thing I really hate at this present moment is, you know, people will say Tucker Carlson, oh, what a populist, or Sagar, what a populist. And I'm like, all of these people come out of – they're either – as in Tucker Carlson's case, I mean, he comes from a pretty well-off family. I think they're like an ice cream company, some magnate. But Sagar, I mean, he comes through these institutions, the same old institutions that we have in D.C. They're part of the blob. And to me, I think we're seeing a move towards – you know, how can we corral these populists back into the fold? Well, the best way to do that is pretend you're a populist.
Yeah. Get in front of the crowd, right? And it's like, you know, what's interesting too is, you know, this should be relatively easy. Like, what I lean on is essentially these people are connected to the neoconservatives. Like Robbie said, there's that famous clip of him on the realignment with Crystal where he goes, "I talked to a lot of lefties and they say like, they're cool with multipolarity." And I'm like, I'm not. I want us to be the only blue water Navy. I want us to right the wrongs of the world. I want us to make sure that China never rules the South China Sea or the Malacca Strait. And he goes on this rant. Now, that's like that's quintessential neoconservatism. That's Krauthammer's unipolar moment. My sort of take on the whole era we're living in is really, you could argue that the neocons, you'd have to go back to like just all the failings of the Iraq war, especially. You know, they really blew that, even if they were trying to accomplish it. Like if you just are objective about it, they blew the whole project. And so now they're still going through. Like if you look at rebuilding America's defenses, they're talking about we're going to wage multiple concurrent large scale successful wars. Well, that was a major failure. We're going to prevent the rise of another great power. That was another major failure. And all this shit about like how, oh, well, we're, you know, reacting to China. If you look at if you look at rebuilding America's defenses, they're talking about the Asia pivot in 2000. This is before 9/11. They've already got this all planned out. They even have the same exact proportions. They're like 2/3 of the naval force, 2/3 of carrier fleets or something. And that's kind of what's been codified into policy under Obama. So my point I make is, look, even if you're on the right, this is a project of PNAC, the real deal, like, you know, cream, whatever, they're the neocons that did this.
They're the intelligentsia. essentially.
Yeah, and it's pushed by – it's led by fucking Obama and Hillary Clinton and Joe Biden. Now, your boy Trump completely sold out to a faction of neocons, particularly the anti-China, anti-Iran neocons, and also the Sheldon Adelson sect.
He hired Elliot Abrams. He hired John Bolton. He hired all the same old players. So.
And expanded the Asia pivot drastically. You know, I mean – so, I mean – Biden is now sailing warships to the Taiwan Strait. He's been in office less than 7 months, and he's already sent warships to the Taiwan Strait 7 times. We flew 75 reconnaissance planes in the South China Sea and near China's coast in we flew planes in the South China Sea and near China's coast 75 times this February. And so if we're spending more on the military than ever, the excuse is China, the pacing threat, the pacing challenge. There's multiple concurrent drills going on now with all these different allies. The British are sending an aircraft carrier strike group now in the South China Sea. They're going to deploy 2 warships permanently in Asia. You got drills going on in Australia. You got the Quad getting ready to go do their annual Malabar drills here in a minute. And it's just on and on and on. And you know, you got people like Tom Cotton and Sajaran Jetty actively talking about decoupling from China, which would make war essentially inevitable at the rate we're going. And, you know, Sagar actually said, you know, trading with China, Alan quotes him here. I think it might be in his stupid book that Tucker and Nina Turner wrote the intro for, that he and Krista wrote, Populist Guide to 2020, where he says, there's a quote where he's like, you know, trading with China is like trading with Nazis before the breakout of World War II. And it's like, this is the most hawkish rhetoric you could possibly have. And so it's a massive dereliction of duty on the part of the, whatever you want to call it, the left or whoever, like the ostensibly alternative media. Like, just I love how they went independent, so now they can legitimately call themselves independent media. But that's some of the most hawkish rhetoric you can find. I haven't seen a clip of somebody on Fox News saying the Chinese are Nazis. I mean, you could argue some of the claims about the Uyghurs are, but that's pretty extreme. And so, I mean, I'll just say I just don't know where this is going. I feel like there has to be people have to say something. I guess what I was saying was Crystal is from MSNBC. So like, why did you take her seriously? Like, oh, I was too far left for MSNBC. That seems like a LARP. Then you've got Buck Sexton, the CIA. That's her co-host. Tucker Carlson's father is vice chairman at the FDD from like 2003 to 2011. Former, what was he? The longest running director of Voice of America, liaison for the, or he led the U.S. Information Agency, set up Radio Marti in Cuba when he was director of Voice of America. He oversaw that. Tucker's had his own shows on Fox News, MSNBC and CNN in my lifetime. How many people have done that? Tried to join the CIA. And then you look at Sagar's background and it's like, how are people just like, what do you think? Do you think that at some point, like, it's kind of like the Trump thing where it's like, surely somebody from the elite will come along to save us at some point. It's like, that's not what's going to happen. And they're always pointing at some enemy, some nation that is supposed to be the new boogeyman that conveniently the neocons have already had their sights on. And they have all the rhetoric ready to go.
What's really interesting about the point you're making, too, is, I mean, I hear two, I would say, incompatible views about China right now from China hawks. One is that, well, I don't want it to be a multipolar world. That's very bad. And then on the other, I hear it's going to be the Chinese century if we don't do something about it. Well, if it's a multipolar world, then no, China will not. And I have to be honest, everyone I talk to seems to indicate, and this includes academics, people in China, diplomats, I don't think China wants to play, you know, what we've been doing, which is Team America World Police. I don't think China wants to be Team China World Police. So which one is it? Is it we're moving towards a multipolar world and we have to stop that, which, you know, I don't know how you stop that at this point. It's already happening. Or is it China's going to take over the world? Which, I mean, I feel like there's a lot of cognitive dissonance with the China hawks on that issue.
Yeah, I mean, I think part of it is basically that it's sort of the way the neocon framing has always been, where it's like any attempt to lower America's stature in the world as Team America World Police, as you said, is seen as basically a dangerous threat. It's like, that's how the neocons see it. They see it as like someone basically coming at them with like a knife about to slit their throat. At least that's, you know, that's how they claim they see it. So they, it's like, it's that in and of itself is so threatening that they have to then just create another fear mongering paradigm and just and keep injecting things into the most sort of reptile brain area, which is this more like the paranoia era you're talking about, that China's going to take over the world. And that sort of starts with, you know, they're infiltrating our culture, our movies, Hollywood, our basketball games, our computers, our software, our TikTok, our children now, you know. Meanwhile, Apple is basically scanning our phones for child pornography, you know, and then basically infiltrating all of our toddlers across the United States to, like, be addicted to touchscreens and devices. And here we are.
Well, I mean, look at this stuff with Pegasus spyware software. Why aren't we talking about that?
Well, yeah, and then that occasionally will come up, the discussion about Israel. But touching back on what Connor mentioned about how now Breaking Points with Cigar and Crystal has the luxury of being like, oh, now we're actually independent. We are on our own independent YouTube channel. Well, then what's the deal with them, their YouTube channel, Breaking Points, hosting the Realignment podcast now? They host the Realignment podcast that is a Hudson Institute creation. Well, I guess that's independent too now. It's just so strange. I mean, you would think they'd want, even just optically, they'd be like, yeah, we're now trying to do this more independent populist thing. We don't need to host the break or the Realignment podcast here. That looks really bad. But they're still doing that. And I find that just kind of bizarre. Like, it just seems like a bad decision, even if they're just trying to rebrand this whole neocon Trojan horse as populism. So I don't get it. But
have you guys seen the clip of, and I think actually this was on Conflicts of Interest when you were on it, Connor, was there's this clip of Sagar talking to Crystal
about Assange.
Yeah, about Assange, and he's like, Assange didn't want to bathe his kitty. He wouldn't let the – no, it was –
he wouldn't even shower.
Yeah,
it's
he wouldn't
disgusting.
Shower and he wouldn't clean out the litter box.
And then Cristobal goes, he's been in there for 6 years. And she starts laughing like a psychotic – it was like Kamala Harris, Hillary Clinton level, like, sociopathy. Like, she's doing that thing where she's faking a smile and, like, gritting her teeth and laughing. It was creepy as fuck. And then Sagar and Jetty's making fun of Julian Assange, who's being tortured. You know, kept in solitary, essentially, you know, locked up in that Ecuadorian embassy. This is before they took him out. But they're making fun of, this is the most important, you could argue, as far as like free speech goes, the most important, one of the most important, if not the most important stories in the world right now. And it's for journalists, it's the most important, and they're making fun of the guy. So it tells you exactly what side they're on, exactly what side. Nobody who's legitimately anti-establishment would ever do that, ever.
I was just going to add to that really quickly. I mean, I'm not sure. Have Sagar and Crystal covered the recent news with that witness that they were using for the case against Assange? I think the hacker, Siggy. You know, have they talked about that and how he's apparently backtracking now to – I mean, he's telling Swedish reporters this. You know, but have they covered it?
Well, I've heard I don't know, but I've seen through the leftists that I follow and like mutuals on Twitter that there's been a dearth of coverage of that from anybody who isn't like in legit like alternative media. Like who like specialize on foreign policy. So I doubt it. I mean, based on that clip, I'm not going to say for sure, but I mean, I haven't heard it.
That clip was kind of like off-putting though. Like I said, it was like, oh, Assange wouldn't clean his cat's litter. He won't bathe but once a week. I'm like, Jesus Christ, dude. And then I think Crystal said, well, these are really important points to bring up.
Yeah, man. Oh, God.
That's really weird.
It's
maybe
a
they were
fascinating
testing,
clip.
Maybe they were testing the waters to see if their audience would stomach some anti-Assange stuff they could sneak in there. You know, if this is an op. But I've noticed they actually have done like pro Assange stuff recently. So maybe that backfired on them at that time. But so far, all of his anti-China stuff, I mean, hasn't seemed to have backfired on them. I still get a lot of pushback, and you'll get a lot of pushback, JG, from this episode, I'm sure. Where people will be like, what are you talking about? None of this stuff you're saying matters. This is guilt by association to say that because he went to a counterterrorism training school in Israel that occupies a former IDF base, you're tarnishing his reputation by guilt by association. I mean, that's the kind of pushback I've gotten on this. So,
for me is, listen, I mean, I will say that, like I said at the beginning, I think Sagar and Crystal have done good work. And, you know, that's not the issue. Like, it's fine that, you know, maybe Sagar is completely honest when he says, you know, the Iraq war awoken me and all this stuff. But, you know, you're really, it's not that much different than the war on terror now. Basically, his view is, well, we're wasting our time in the Middle East. Let's, you know, have a war with China. Or let's have more conflict with China. And to me, it's like, that's, I don't accept that either.
Most mainstream pieces about why it ultimately makes sense to leave Afghanistan after 20 years end with something about how, yeah, now we need to focus on China. They're the real threat. And that's a lot of people are saying that now. That's what I mean, too. It's like, it's such an interesting transition. And it seems to me that the independent media co-optation or infiltration is absolutely imperative for them, because there is this Afghan war syndrome. There is this war on terror syndrome. Everybody knows, even if they don't think about it all the time, that millions of people are now dead and displaced, killed. And we spent $6 trillion. We're $8 trillion. We have it's like $8 trillion in interest on these wars. And that's not even all of them. This is just like, you know, Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, Pakistan, the drone war in Pakistan. Like, but the way that they kind of go, like, they kind of brush it aside and they're like, we haven't been focusing on the real threat. And I love how Republicans can like, that's part of Tucker's thing. He'll honestly laugh at the anti-Russia hysteria again, where they go like, that was, come on, that's easy to see. That's propaganda. That's so transparent. Russia's not a real threat. Now, China, on the other hand, and his audience just consumes that. The way I've looked at it, because, you know, I come from I used to work in restaurants, and the way I see it is like, it reminds me of like side work. It's just division of labor. They can't run John McCain and Hillary Clinton forever, and they know that that doesn't work anymore. Everybody hates them, you know, that explode everything neocon centrist imperialist shtick. So they go with, okay, so Tulsi's really good. She's, you know, from Kufi and hanging out with Netanyahu and what's his name, Pastor John Hagee, and
also Rick Santorum. Big Modi fan, according to some people, but.
Yeah, I mean, and I need to know more about that. I'm sure that's true.
I know she has pushed back on that, but that's for another time. Go on.
But, you know, it's a huge perpetual war in the Middle East against any Sunni with a rifle, like Scott Horton says. You look at there's a ton of people. Like I said, Sanders, Trump is the most egregious one, because people legitimately think Trump was anti-war, and they think he was like some anti-neocon guy who just couldn't put up enough of a fight. Which is such a misreading, I think, honestly. I don't know what exactly happened with Trump, but I think it needs to be looked through the lens of part of this transition for the neoconservatives.
Can I be honest? When it comes to Trump, when people say to me, oh, well, he could not overcome the deep state, I always say to people, well, then he sucks at 4D chess. I thought he was supposed to be good at 4D chess.
Right.
You know, like, there are no excuses to me anymore.
So no, when you're killing children.
Yeah.
I don't understand. I never understood that. But it's also because I'm not on a team. I'm nationalist. I don't sympathize with the right or the left any more than I do with anybody else, or even the libertarian. I'm just who I am. And so I only talk about this issue. So it allows me to be objective. So I wrote some things about him at the very end of his administration, just like showing like, this is what you got. Like, he ran on ending the war in Syria. Look at what is happening now. You've got the Caesar Act. He bombed Russians in Syria. Bombed Russians in the beginning of February. Or was it February 2018? I remember that came over Reuters and saw that shit. And just, you know, I don't understand this. Michael Morell is out there saying in like 2016 on Charlie Rose, we ought to kill Russians in Syria. We ought to kill Iranians in Syria. And everybody's like, whoa. And, you know, Hillary Clinton goes, this no fly zone thing. And he's permanently occupying the eastern part of the country there. They've got the Caesar Act and they're taking the oil. And it's just, and what we don't, they know how many troops are there technically, but it's this permanent occupation. Israel bombs the country every week now, or every other week. And I don't know. I mean, that's just one example. The new Cold War stuff was so escalated under Trump, just to ripping up arms treaties and sanctions and expelling diplomats and
including
arming
arms
Ukraine.
Treaties with Russia.
Yeah, the New START. Excuse me, not New START. He probably would have let New START expire, but the INF treaty and Open Skies. And the Russians offered to Biden to come back into Open Skies after he went back into New START, after they extended it at the beginning when he came in, and they said no. Foggy, the State Department said, we don't want to send the Russians the wrong message. And we've had just drills going on constantly in the Black Sea. And within the first few days of first week, I think, of Biden's administration, he flew B-52s over the Persian Gulf, just like Trump, sent, I think, 3 warships into the Black Sea and sent an aircraft carrier into the South China Sea.
I want to know when we're going to rejoin the JCPOA, as was promised, but apparently that's not happening, the Iran deal.
Yeah, well, Ray McGovern and Joe Loria said right at the beginning that whole SolarWinds thing would be used as a way to keep Biden from getting really far with arms control talks with Russia, and getting back into the Iran deal. And I think all this ransomware hysteria is a part of that same strategy.
So before we close out, we have 10 or so minutes to go, but I wanted to ask both of you, how did Sagar come on your radar? Do you want to start with that one, Robbie?
Sure. I think probably maybe even the Joe Rogan program. I can't exactly remember. I mean, I definitely remember it was probably either Glenn Greenwald or the Joe Rogan program. And, you know, very early on, Joe Rogan and Greenwald were really pushing them. I mean, it seems like Sagar is Joe Rogan's biggest influences. I mean, there's quite a lot of anti-China propaganda coming off of that program now, which is interesting to me. So I guess that's probably how, JG, honestly. I can't remember exactly, though.
It might have been Robbie, honestly. And I'll just say with the Rogan thing, I don't really watch that much propaganda. I just focus on usually reading stuff, people I can trust and listening to good podcasts and that sort of thing. And some I have to kind of now to understand some of the more rhetoric. I'd rather read it than actually watch it. It's hard for me to watch people like Sagar. It's just uncomfortable for me. But I'll just say, speaking of that Rogan thing, there's something weird because like he kind of boosted Dave Rubin and the IDW too, and there's a lot of neocon connections there too, and he brought on Barry Weiss, and we see Tim Dillon kind of doing the same thing where he brought her on immediately after he had Abby on to talk about Palestine. And you're just like, I think it's similar to me where you look at, okay, so like why is there this pattern where these guys go from being quasi anti-establishment? If you remember Rogan's show, like back when it was the Joe Rogan Experience, it wasn't what it became in the last 5 or 6 years or whatever. And it was him and Duncan Trussell smoking weed talking about, you know, you remember Obama came out and gave that speech about how we have to bomb Syria, they're killing children with chemical weapons, and they were getting high and laughing their asses off at him in real time. This is in like 2013, and going, you set children on fire with your sky robots. And they were like, it was fucking funny, and it was legit. I don't know what you call it, but it's like that was important to do for real, like for the platform that they had and the time that they did that. That was, you wouldn't see that now. I sincerely doubt you'd see that from a major comedian or major comedian's platform. I think in the Trump era, you'll notice substance was kind of extracted from comedy, really obviously, too. Like you notice it's more about product placement and kind of promoting each other. They don't talk about anything very important except occasionally on the Rogan podcast when he has a good guest on. But I've gotten to the point where I think he has good people on there just to maintain some credibility. At some point, his show. Like, by the way, Dave Rubin's whole like success after the Young Turks, I don't think would have been possible without him going on Rogan a couple times to be like, I used to be a liberal, but now the SJWs are freaking me out with the pronouns and all this sort of thing.
I wanted to mention, since Barry Weiss came up yet again, the disgrace of my city, as they call her, she's a good example of what we're talking about, where I think there's this infiltration that goes on. I don't know if you want to call it like a deliberate infiltration, but Barry Weiss can go on and on about I'm Miss Free Speech now. No, you aren't.
Oh, it's disgusting.
She got Palestinian scholars, pro-Palestinian scholars, fired from their jobs well, she was in university, but I'm supposed to believe that she's free speech. Like, and I feel like we get the same thing with people saying they're anti-war, except for China.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So yeah, it's side work. That's what I meant. They divide up the responsibilities. You look at like Tulsi. We don't like Tulsi. I don't think anybody here. Well, I don't know about you, JG, but I'm pretty cynical about what she was up to.
I'll never forget. I'm very cynical about Tulsi. Yes.
Yeah. Dude, when she didn't tweet shit.
I shouldn't say anything.
The whole bombing of Gaza. And anyway, I'll just say like the whole thing when Barry Weiss came on there and called her a toady on the Syria thing. Like Barry Weiss can't help. She is cancel culture, which is why I thought it was really weird when even like Reason Magazine was promoting her as like some free speech warrior. Can you – another victim of the cancel culture. You're like, this is so – it's just too transparent.
So well, I want to come back to the comedy thing with Robbie here, because I know, Robbie, you said you had some thoughts on where comedy has gone since at least the Trump era.
Well, I mean, I have a pretty paranoid theory that comedy has been a vehicle for sort of neocon propaganda for a while. I mean, if you look at the people who had a USO tour show gigs during the Bush administration, it's a lot of like these Louis C.K. connected comedians. And really the only thing that connected them back then was the Opie and Anthony program and sort of this weird red eye, you know, Fox News pipeline. So, I have thoughts about the comedy scene in general. I think it's odd that Tim Dillon went from being like seemingly legitimately anti-establishment to now seeming like he's getting, you know, basically like worked by all these different, you know, people like Barry Weiss and people like that. But in the Trump era, yeah, Trump, I mean, comedy has completely seemingly gotten ruined. I mean, especially
I think
on
it
the
broke
left.
Stephen Colbert's brain.
Yeah, definitely broke Stephen Colbert's brain. He was crying. I mean, like, it was basically the first week of his Late Show when he actually took the gig, the Late Show with Stephen Colbert. Even before Trump, I was like, this is one of the most horrifying, cringe things I've ever seen. He had like Joe Biden on to cry about his son dying from brain cancer. And like, it was insane. But yeah, Stephen Colbert is totally toast. Michael Ian Black turned into like a weird weaponized Russiagator who like went after my sister for no reason. Tim and Eric seem cool. They have us on. You know, a lot of people even complain when I go on or I've been on what's it called, Office Hours, because I guess they were, you know, they say like Vic Berger's a Russiagator or whatever. I mean, they seem pretty cool politically, much cooler than most of the, you know, the people in that side of the comedy scene. And then there's also like, you know, Bill Burr still seems like he's got pretty good politics for the most part.
I like Bill Burr. He gets attacked by all sides, it seems like.
Yeah, there's people who still seem real about what they're doing. But even some of those people fall prey to some of, you know, the rip from the headlines stuff, because they're just probably just, you know, need to write material every year. So, of course, they're going to, you know, pull from the zeitgeist of culture. But I think people like Bill Hicks, like we were talking about before the show started, are like, that's kind of a thing of the past. I mean, there's really nobody like that anymore who's really irreverent. And I mean, Doug Stanhope still is a little bit of that, like you were saying. But it's completely changed. And yeah, and I do think it ruins comedy from the other side to have everybody so woke and, you know, worried about what they're going to say or who they're going to offend, because that was part of the fun of comedy all along. And now we have people who are really leaning into the anti-PC thing, who almost make a performance out of that and get sort of boring and repetitive, you know, groove.
Oh, so God, it's like, don't really mention Sam Hyde.
You don't really have anybody anymore who's just like, yeah, fuck all this shit. You know,
well, there's nothing
like
more.
Patrice O'Neill is not alive anymore.
Oh, hell yeah. No, yeah. Patrice and Hicks, it's just like, we need them and the people who have taken their places. Like, to me, like, Tim Dillon occupies that space now, and it's totally illegitimate. That's just my opinion. But I'm a huge, like I said, Hicks and Patrice fan, and Stanhope's probably my favorite living comic. I have a real respect for what can be done with that medium. So my standards are really high, and I just get depressed when people either, you know, carry water for power or they're just not doing anything substantive with it. At least be funny. And I just haven't seen a lot of that lately. The comedy podcast used to be great. And I feel like in the last few years, I don't know, I'm just being honest, it hasn't been. But maybe it's just I've changed and I'm focused on other things, but it's hard to listen to them now.
I was going to say with Bill Hicks, it's interesting to me. I think with Generation X, he was very popular, but I noticed a lot of millennials and Gen Z do not like Bill Hicks. And my theory is that it's because a lot of what he said back in the 90s has actually come to pass. You know, like he used to have the joke about, you know, are you an advertiser? He's like, kill yourself. He's like, no, there's no punchline to this. And I'm like, you know, everyone, we sort of have turned into, he called it a consumer plantation. And I mean, that's almost what politics has become at this point, too. You're either, you know, oh, are you a Sagar fan, a Tucker Carlson fan, or are you a Rachel Maddow fan, or are you a Sam Cedar fan, or are you a Jimmy Dore fan? And it's like, I don't care. All of these people may have good points or bad points. And I don't like this rah-rah team BS. I want to get into the analysis.
Yeah, there's almost also like a thing where people like laugh at what Hicks was doing. And like, I almost think like Heidecker's character in the leather jacket or thing. I've heard people who are fans of him tell me that that's like sort of a mockery of like Carlin and Hicks. And I don't know, maybe it is, maybe it isn't. But there's definitely an aversion to people really trying to, you know, make a point, it seems like. There's a kind of nihilism. To your point, I think it's people just accepting. I think we've honestly, I mean, not to get too negative, but I think after the war on terror and going in, the way how smooth the transition has been into great power competition, I think you've looked at in the last several, you can go back further if you want, but at least in the last 10 years, popular movies, you can't even go to the theater anymore to see a fucking good movie. The last movie I saw in theaters was Taxi Driver on one of those nights where they're like, we're playing a classic. Like, otherwise, good luck, man. Like, but I think it all goes back to foreign policy because it's all that matters anymore. And there's just, I think that when you live in a fucking fascist empire and it's declining, you can see the writing on the wall in a lot of different ways. And I think part of it is a decline in the arts, and at least in the mainstream, because that's not true as far as the independent scenes go. But I'm just saying that like what's promoted in the mainstream like is just dog shit, and it's demoralizing. It sucks.
And to your point, I mean, I think the mockery of Bill Hicks has to do with like Bill Hicks would go on stage and get angry. He would get angry. I mean, there's the famous "I'm Sorry, Folks" bootleg, which I think is one of the funniest things ever. But like, it's almost like showing passion about a subject now, or about things happening in the world, is now outlawed. Culturally, that's not cool. And I'm kind of tired of it. Like, I wish we were more passionate about, you know, things like we bomb children in faraway countries. We sanction entire countries, not even targeted sanctions, but sanctions that starve people. And we're supposed to not be passionate and angry about these things? I think that's where we're at right now.
Yeah, it goes on all day, and we've just absorbed neoconservatism like the air we breathe. Like Robbie was saying, like, if we can't have full-spectrum dominance, then it's a threat. It's terrifying. And people are very eager to buy this up, because my theory is that as much as people on the right love to go, or even libertarians, like, look at people in Cuba or wherever and go, you should overthrow your government. It's like, first of all, don't say that if you're not willing to do it here, one. And two, it's like, you know, maybe you should do something. Like, why do you care so much about other people? I think Americans love looking at these other states like North Korea. Like, you know, it's kind of like Michael Malice is kind of plays into this in the libertarian world, and it really annoys me. But like, I mean, it's fair. There's some fair criticisms to make, but like, I don't spend my time talking about how North Korea is a totalitarian dictatorship. Like, I subscribe to Daniel McAdams' rule, which is basically like, don't do the empire's work for them. Like, why would you talk about, you know, why would you help them with their propaganda? Like, I want to get the sanctions lifted. I want to trade with those people. I want them to be healthy. I don't really care if people in Cuba want communism. I have no interest in telling other people in other countries how they should live, or how their government should function, or what kind of economic system they should pursue. I think until we get freedom here, we should shut the fuck up and focus on what we're doing. I mean, that's just how I feel. That's why I focus on foreign policy.
That's sort of my approach too, where, and I think Robbie, you have this approach too. I mean, there are things that I am critical of, you know, even I've had, like I said, I've had guests that are critical of China on. I've had guests that are critical of Putin. But my main focus has always been at home here in the U.S. because, I don't think I can, I'm certainly not going to affect policy in China or Russia. I don't know that I'm going to affect policy in the US, but at least people here will listen, and maybe you can build up a movement to push back against the blob.
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree with you, JG. I think that's a really good reason to not play into this. And I also just think another good reason not to is just on like on a spiritual, like, you know, like your own identity, who you know, your own character. It's like, do you really want to, you know, basically play into this? do you want to basically act as if you're entitled enough to even make a judgment call on it? Just even if you don't believe in the U.S. militarily intervening, just the mere thought that it's like you should have some place in judging another country's behavior like that just seems like something that's just very entitled and uniquely American. You know, I'm sure people in other Western countries have a similar point of view, but I do think it's something that we've have ingrained in us that's just very ugly about our character and sort of our spiritual being here as people in this society. And I just think it's something that we should be ashamed of and we should try to deprogram ourselves of, because, you know, it allows thoughts. Even if you're just a, you know, a progressive person, a lot of progressives out there, and even some libertarians, like Scott was going after this one guy in particular, still believe in this sort of cold equations framework of looking at dropping two nuclear bombs on Japan. And it's like, that is to me completely born out of this entitlement and brainwashing of being, you know, this uniquely American. And I think that that's something that we really should try to basically erase from ourselves.
Yeah, the American exceptionalism is hard to scrub off, but it's we got to do it. That's what I mean. It's like there's this phrase that goes around sometimes with libertarians where they're like, you know, anarcho-capitalists. They'll be like, "Ancapistan." They'll be like, "We're never going to get to Ancapistan." And the thing I've been thinking about is like, well, wait a minute. What does that even mean? Why don't you try and get as far as you can here? Why, because I don't understand why people would want to waste their time pointing at other countries and going, God, can you believe how like they have no free? And like, I think there is kind of a fetish in looking at places like North Korea, for instance, and, and just kind of looking down your nose and going, they don't have freedom. It's like, we don't have freedom. What are you talking about? And and also, like, Jesus Christ. It's like, okay, so like one time I remember I was at a restaurant and I heard this family talking about how this kid, I was working at a restaurant. I heard this conversation with this family. They're saying that like their son is like working with like a foreign exchange student in China. And they're like, well, there were some things I wanted to ask her about the situation there, but I can't ask until she comes over here. Cause you know, they spy on all their people through their like electronic devices. And he's like, I'm worried they might be spying on us too. And the father was like, they may be spying on us. The Chinese, they're spying on Americans. They're spying on Americans now everywhere with the TikTok and the this, that, and the, and you're just like, I don't know what you do with. I don't know what you do with that. I think Americans will go to war with. Okay, this is really negative, and I don't want. This is. I'm just saying. I could see Americans wanting to literally go to nuclear war with China before they really challenge their own fucking government.
Well, people always say, "Oh, a war with China couldn't happen," and I mean, there even are. I mean, there's people in the CFR like Philip Zelikow that have written. You know, Zelikow wrote a recent piece saying we can't go to war with China. That is insane. So even people that aren't really even on our side, that aren't like super anti-war or, you know, pro-restraint, as I would put it, even those people understand that the tiniest escalation can evolve into something unpredictable. I mean, wars happen. Just the tiniest escalation can cause a catastrophe is what I'm getting at.
Yeah, one of my things about the whole Sagar thing and Tim Pool, just one example, is the hatred, the venom that was unleashed at John Cena. Getting back to our point about the deterioration of the arts. First of all, why is Cena one of the number one actors in the country? Hollywood is dead, by the way. Like, everybody should know that. It's over. It's finished. It's done. Has been for a long time. Connor, real quick.
So the last time I was in L.A., I was walking down the streets, down the Hollywood Walk of Fame, and there was this family there with Chicago accents, and they were looking around, and they're like, this is it? This is Hollywood? Where's the glamour? What is this? And they were just like, oh, this was a waste of a plane ticket. But
it's, yeah, man. And the, like I said, the writing's on the wall. And it's like, you know, I love how they're mad at Cena for wanting to make whatever millions, hundreds of millions of dollars for that stupid movie. It's one of our greatest franchises in America now.
Fast and the Furious.
Yeah.
27 or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. You know, we're so proud. No one's better than us. He wants to make some more money on that. And he, by the way, made a faux pas. He's restating the U.S. policy, just like that whole gotcha moment with the World Health Organization where they're like, they wouldn't recognize Taiwan. That's U.S. longstanding U.S. policy. If you have a problem with it, take it up with Richard Nixon and Jimmy Carter. And we haven't changed that. Now, the thing is, they hate him and they, you know, everybody made fun of him and called him every name in the book. But by the way, and just as an aside, people should be mad at the fact that the guy's been virtually a recruiter for like 2 decades. Like his whole like camouflage shorts and the salute and the USO shows and all of the Marine movie. Like his whole thing is like, you think I'm a hero? I look like a soldier, don't I? You're the real heroes are the American soldiers in Iraq right now fighting for freedom. Like that's his whole life. He's a, what Hicks called pituitary retards, you know what I mean? Bashing their fucking skulls together. It's just the same thing. Now, they don't know about Randall Shriver. In early 2018, this guy worked with Richard Armitage for years. Trump gets him in there as Assistant Secretary of State for Assistant Secretary of Defense for Asian and Pacific Security Affairs. And he engineers, Gareth Porter has a piece about this, these Fortress Taiwan arms sales. And he had been long backed by like the Taiwanese Defense Ministry, the State Department, Lockheed, through this group he had with Armitage called the Project 2049 Institute. And, you know, this is a longstanding thing because his group was a part of a thing called the U.S.-Taiwan Business Council headed by Wolfowitz after he left the World Bank. And they were saying like Obama and Bush, they won't give them these upgraded F-16s, not since H.W. Bush, have we sold Taiwan these F-16s? And why is everybody being such pussies about this? So they get in there and they engineer this massive arms sale, huge escalation. These are these Boeing standoff land attack missiles, these AGM-84E missiles that can be fired from the F-16s to hit inland targets, deep inland targets, civilian and military in Nanking in China. And nobody cares about that. It's the great Gareth described it as the worst escalation in U.S.-China relations in years. And nobody knows who he is. Nobody cares. And, you know, Sadra and Jetty keeps reiterating in his bit about Cena. If you watch that clip, he keeps going and he goes, but Cena's an American. And as Americans, we believe that Taiwan is a – he starts like it's intrinsic to the American character. You have to have this ardent neoconservative like PNAC take on Taiwan about how we ought to – like Tom Cotton, you know. And he didn't say like strategic clarity or anything like that, but just this idea of taking this hawkish stance that Taiwan is its own country and it's you know, the kind of the separatist notion that's taking – it's picking up a lot of steam, you know, with the current administration in Taiwan. And it's just, I don't know, man. It's just, I don't understand the hatred of people like Cena. I'm focused on people like that, like Shriver, and who, by the way, was then in the office of Tsai Ing-wen in Taiwan, and she couldn't thank him enough for the arms sales. And it's like, and then Tim Pool got into that discussion about Taiwan or the Abraham's Accords with Scott Horton. And Scott goes, you know, they're just selling the Palestinians out and encircling Iran. It's a big, corporate welfare scheme for the military industrial complex. It's not a peace deal, because Tim Pool's going, oh, Trump was a success in the Middle East with his peace deals. And Tim Pool, who shits himself every day about Taiwan, says to Scott, why should I care about Palestine?
I was going to say, I'm glad that Scott Horton got to drop some truth bombs on the Tim Pool show. But last thing, I know we've gone over the hour here, so there were two more things I wanted to mention. The first is, one of the reasons Salgaard came under my radar again, especially in the last few months, and I was talking about this before we started recording, people kept posting these videos of Salgaard and Jetty talking about the Pentagon's UFO report. And it was all this cutesy BS of, I want to believe, and yeah, he was like really into it. And I'm like, you know, have you ever thought about how these things are used for defense spending? Oh, well, that's what the report even says. Well, we need to investigate this further. Give us more money. And it's not really cutesy stuff. I mean, I know it gets treated as like a kooky topic, and I really don't think we're being visited by anyone. I just think this is all sort of a way to get us to spend more on the defense budget. But it's not cutesy, and I don't like the cutesy sort of thing that Sagar does a lot of times, especially we mentioned it earlier with Assange. Like, oh, well, he didn't clean his kitty's cat litter, and I'm like, what? Why are we doing this cutesy BS?
Well, I think it's to lull people into supporting these policies, because otherwise you'd be like, why are, you know, we were just saying earlier, Russia and China have this idea for a lunar, joint lunar mission. I forget exactly what they called it, but then Space Force came out and said, nah, we need to turn the moon into a militarized front. It may be a venue for a future war. And it's like everybody makes these jokes. Like, I also like, it's just weird, like the Trump shit where people are just like, China, China. It's like, have you been paying attention to what's happening with US-China policy? What's the joke? I don't get it. Like, what's the joke about Space Force? It's part of an old PNAC plot. I don't know. Maybe I don't see the humor in it, but I think that's part of it, man.
And the last thing I was going to mention, because I'm going to get accused of this for this episode. Oh, well, you're purity spiraling now. And I don't see how I'm purity spiraling when I'm having – I mean, Connor, I think we would disagree on a lot of things probably domestically, right? I mean, libertarian – sort of someone to the left of libertarians in many, many ways. But we can come together on certain issues. I mean, I've had people recently be critical that I've had so many guests on from the Quincy Institute. They'll say, well, I don't agree with this specific Quincy Institute person. And I'm like, yeah, well, we have to build coalitions. So I'm not saying that it's bad for someone that is a conservative or a libertarian and a progressive to all get together in a room and say, we all agree on this. But I don't think that is what Tucker Carlson, Tim Pool, and all these other figures are doing. I think they're trying to sheepdog us into more of the same old neoconservative warmongering.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that's how you should look at it, because that's exactly what they're doing. I mean, I have no dispute with that at all. And I think it's also interesting that Tucker Carlson was also pushing the UAP report as a very serious thing and saying this is why we need to enrich things like Space Force. So it's interesting that, you know, these guys are supposed to be anti-war and anti-military industrial complex and talk a lot about how we're, you know, spending too much money in these various foreign policy adventures. But then they both, you know, want us to take the UAP thing very seriously. And I think, you know, regardless of how you fall on the UFO UAP thing, I think that it's pretty obvious that regardless of what it is, our government is going to use it in some way to manipulate us. And they're basically cherry picking what they're showing us. Even if some of these videos are totally legit, I mean, they don't really mean anything. You know, we're going by these eyewitness testimonies and such. But yeah.
Just what I was going to say, too, the reason I brought up Quincy and coalition building is because I don't know if you guys saw it, but there was a recent article, I think it was in Survive or Survival Magazine, some, you know, centrist, wonky sort of magazine, and it talked about the Quincy Coalition, and you're all secret isolationists if you don't support the Empire's wars. And every month we see increased attacks on not just the Quincy Institute, but also things like the Center for International Policy and think tanks that I tend to agree with on foreign policy. And yet, you know, attacks on those groups or attacks on even antiwar.com. I've seen people say, oh, it's a Russian asset website. You know, we get attacks on these people doing really good work. But if I criticize Sagar and Jetty, oh, how could you criticize Sagar? it's bizarre to me. We're not picking the right targets when it comes to who we work with and who we criticize. And everyone should be open to criticism, including myself. If people want to criticize me for this episode, go right ahead. But we need to work together on a lot of things. We also need to be critical where we have to be critical. Any closing comments, Connor and Robbie?
I'll just say I think you're absolutely right. Right before Trump came into office, there was the whole proper not thing, and I think that policy, that was where they really, the mask, look,
they
we
went after
knew this
Black Agenda Report, they went after
Counterpunch.com.
No one mentions, but no one mentions
Ron
that,
Paul Institute.
The left doesn't mention that they went after left-wing websites like Black Agenda Report and Counterpunch. That's why I didn't like the Proper Not stuff.
Oh, Consortium News was in there.
What's that?
Consortium News was in there,
yeah,
too.
Yeah.
And it, so they showed their hand totally. And the fact that I still look at a lot of the whole Russia hysteria as, yeah, dual purpose, like build up for the new Cold War. It's kind of a great a big part of it, I think, was actually to set the stage for what we're talking about now, because now you have a completely warped internet culture that doesn't know what independent really means. Like Breaking Points, we just talked about it. They're hosting the Hudson Institute's Realignment podcast. How independent can you be? You know, it's but, you know, I would prefer that people like, you know, antiwar.com and the Ron Paul Institute and the Libertarian Institute and Consortium News and, you know, Mint Press and, you know, Quincy, like these are the sites that people should be reading. And there's so many more. I don't mean to leave, you know, so many out, but like, I'm just saying, like, that people need to be aware of that, because those sites have been there for a long time, and that's where the real coalition is. That's where the anti-war coalition is. That's the whole point of antiwar.com. They run everything from, you know, Buchanan to Chomsky. And it's like, that's, I see that as being like the most important fight. So like, that's why I have a particular chip on my shoulder for people like Sagar, because this is so obviously, like, we just broke down like his whole background and what the way the thing works, and people just don't accept it, and they just keep. Yeah, I don't know.
What I was gonna say is, you know, I feel like if you were to say what we're saying about U.S.-China relations to Sagar, and I'm admittedly pretty moderate on the issue of U.S.-China relations, I can be critical of China, but I think that, you know, I just don't think pushing more conflict is a very good idea, and I think the U.S. Is doing that now. The thing I don't get is antiwar.com, the Quincy Institute, I think they are truly transpartisan. I've never had an issue with anyone at anti-war over my politics, but I feel like if you were to talk about some of this China stuff with people like Matt Stoller or Sagar and Jetty, they would flip out. So that's how I feel.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. I don't really know what final comments I have, except for I think part of, to your question, JG, about why do people freak out so much when you criticize people like Sagar or Tucker or even Trump at times. It does seem like a lot of these people who, you know, on the left rightfully despise Hillary, it's like they'll even get like triggered when you criticize Trump. And it's like, what, like, are you some kind of Dem? It's like, no, relax, buddy. I'm also saying Trump is fucking fake. Like, you don't think he's fake? Like, what do you, I thought you were real. I thought, you know, you hated Hillary and Trump. There's often this weird mentality when you get into this realm of populist rhetoric, because it really hits people in this zone where they really want to believe. They really want to believe, you know, and a lot of these people like to throw around the word synthetic leftist. Oh, you're a synthetic leftist if you, you know, watch TYT. I mean, I think TYT is trash, but at the same time, a lot of those people are like Tulsi diehards, or they love Sagar, and it's like, what is going on here? So I think that what Sagar has hit on is just the utility and the value and the success rate of hitting on these populist issues. You know, look at how successful Trump was, the Trump model. Tucker is emulating that. Sagar is emulating that. And I think that that's really why it makes so many people get into this weird defensive state, because they want to believe that Sagar is real. They want to believe that he is a representative of right and left populism somehow working together. But like you said, Connor, they've skipped over places like anti-war. They've skipped over people like Scott Horton. I mean, I remember even back in the day, Caitlin Johnstone was promoting this idea that to fight the deep state, the left needs to work with Mike Cernovich and Jack Posobiec. And I'm like, wait, hold on a second. Why aren't you talking about all these people who have been doing this work for decades, who are really tried and true anti-war, anti-deep state people?
I mean, isn't Jack Posobiec military intelligence or naval intelligence?
We don't know who these people are. Like, why are you promoting these motherfuckers? They're like clearly like it's some bizarre like front. So I mean, it's just stuff like that that really blows my mind. But I think that that just speaks to, again, the danger that's happening here. This is almost like Invasion of the Body Snatchers level, where it's already infiltrated so deeply that you are having a lot of, like, loyal fans. It is kind of like, why are you going after Cigar, man? This is guilt by association. I hate war. He hates war. It's like, no. I mean, that's how creepy it's gotten. I would say it's Invasion of the Body Snatchers level for me at this point.
Yeah, and I'll say in fairness, I think Caitlin has repudiated that stuff. But like with that, but I will say this, man, a lot of libertarians still like Cernovich and like Jack Posobiec. And if you look at Tim Pool, the phenomenon you talk about with Tucker getting that sort of steady stream of celeb left guests who then don't, even if they're good on China, even if they're some of the best people on the goddamn issue, they won't call out Tucker. Because for whatever reason, when Occam's razor, I think, is because they don't want to jeopardize their relationship with him. But I'll just say I could see Tim Pool doing that with libertarians at some point, if he isn't already trying to do that already, because I don't know if enough people are hip to this to the point where they could actually call him out effectively the way Scott did on this whole propaganda train. And then. Yeah, I mean, it's bizarre that, like, somebody like Posobiec can just, like, be a part of the anti-establishment, like, orbit. And dude, that piece I put out, Faux Populist Shill for the Permanent War State, because I went after Tucker, somebody commented in the Libertarian Institute thread, they go, this is a bunch of bullshit from Mr. Freeman trying to get in the good graces of his shit-lib friends like at his shit-lib cocktail parties. Yeah, yeah, oh I'm going God. To cocktail parties.
We're allowed to talk about Anderson Cooper being recruited by the CIA all day long, but, you know, it's like nobody even talks about the fact that, like, Tucker's dad ran the CIA media arm and he tried to join it. It's like everybody should know all that shit about these people. Why are we only knowing it about the libs?
He literally cited that, the stuff I was saying about Tucker, and he goes, "That's your evidence?"
Yeah.
Like, this guy tried to join the CIA. Isn't it at all sus that he's had his own show on CNN, MSNBC, and Fox News, and now he's the big outsider? Like, oh, watch out for this guy. He's a loose cannon. He just happens to be the best anti-China hawk, like, it literally in terms of his effectiveness.
And he used to write for the Weekly Standard. He used to work for Bill Kristol, which is so funny.
Oh, my fucking God.
So I feel like we could probably go on for another hour if we wanted to. I have some stuff I have to do, though, so real quick. Just as briefly as possible, because I do have some other things I have to work on. Connor and Robbie, how can people keep up with your work?
Follow me. All my work is at the Libertarian Institute, libertarianinstitute.org. I'm often on Conflicts of Interest with Kyle Anzalone and Will Porter, one of the best foreign policy shows on the internet. You can follow me on Twitter at freemansmind96.
You can check out my work, mostly on the Media Roots Radio podcast is where I do it. If you want to check out the movie that Connor mentioned, you can go to veryheavyagenda.com. I still sell DVD copies of it, although it's HD online streaming. I think it's better to watch it that way. I'm trying to think what else. Oh, yeah. And then Abby's got a new film coming out. About the military-industrial complex and how basically the Pentagon is one of the biggest polluters on the planet. So look forward to that as well.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Robbie Martin and Connor Freeman. As always, if you can, please, 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 please consider supporting me on patreon.com/parallaxviews. That's patreon.com/parallaxviews. There is everything from a $1 tier to a $15 tier. And at the $5 tier, you get exclusive Parallax Views content, such as archived editions of previous shows. And tomorrow, hopefully, before the end of the month, a conversation about George H.W. Bush and his legacy in terms of the parapolitical. So that should be an exciting episode. Actually, it'll be part one of a two-parter. Also, at the $10 and $15 tiers, you get a producer's credit shout-out. Producer's credit shout-outs to Mark, Arlen, Spartacus, Gunner, Ed, Gratz, James, Mickey, Brian, The Warnerd, TJ, Nick, Emilia, Chase, Chris, Orc, Black Tuna, Catherine, Nathan, David, Holland, Martin, Brian S., and Jeffrey. If you'd like your very own producer's credit on each and every edition of Parallax Views, consider joining those listeners in supporting me at the $10 or $15 tiers of my Patreon page at patreon.com/parallaxviews. That's patreon.com/parallaxviews. And with that being said,
until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight. With no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.